Thank you, Hugh. So I want to thank Hugh, and as well as Raffle and the organizers of this meeting for inviting me to talk. I understand this is a Canadian workshop on physical genomics. Unfortunately, I have no affiliations directly to Canada. However, I do have a great love for Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver. So maybe you can think of me as, you know, a Canadian wannabe giving a talk here. So what I'll be talking about is very much motivated by a collaboration at Michigan with a cancer biologist. It's looking at developing physical methods for clustering, but what you'll see is that sort of the scientific questions are going to guide what kinds of methods I'll be talking about. So here's the outline for my talk. I want to talk a little bit about sort of the general area of genomics, again, very broad scales, talk about sort of what the scientific goals are and how these potentially translate into statistical goals. And in particular, in this talk, I'll be focusing on clustering gene expression data. Talk a fair amount about what's been done previously in the literature, and then talk about the approaches we've taken in our group. So first one is going to deal with using mixture models for clustering microdata. And obviously, this has been mentioned, because we have generally small numbers of subjects, but we're taking high-dimensional measurements, sort of one approach we've been looking at is combining dimension reduction approaches with mixture modeling. Another thing I'll be talking about are using resampling, or what I'll call subsampling methods, for looking at individual clusters of samples to see how stable or unstable they might be. I want to illustrate this work with some examples and then talk, and in particular, I think there are a fair amount of graduate students in the audience. I do want to talk about where I think the field is headed for clustering microarray data. Okay, so this workshop on physical genomics, I think what you'll see throughout this workshop is that there are going to be lots of experiments and studies where people are basically analyzing collecting high-dimensional data, but they're doing it on very small numbers of subjects. And given two examples here, microarrays, which I'm sure most of you have heard a lot of talks about, as well as something else called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. But I think this, sort of these issues are sort of common to both sets of studies. But in this talk, I'll be focusing on microarrays. Okay, so the scientific goals, at least in the cancer setting, what I'll be talking about are, I think, threefold. So the first is what I'm calling biomarker discovery. So that's an issue of scientists or cancer biologists want to know what kinds of genes might discriminate between various types of cancer. I work with prostate cancer. They're very interested in finding genes that discriminate between aggressive prostate cancer, that's prostate cancer that metastasizes, versus non-aggressive. So the reason this is because if you look at a population of men ages 70 to 75, you'll find that roughly a quarter of them have prostate cancer. But in most cases, that prostate cancer is not lethal, meaning it won't kill them. So they want to figure out, how can we figure out which are the aggressive prostate cancers, which are the non-aggressive prostate cancers. So that's an example of what I'm calling biomarker discovery. Another reason I think people are interested in biomarker discovery is sort of to better understand the biology behind prostate cancer. Other two bullet points are what have been called class prediction and class discovery. So class prediction is very much related to what Rob was talking about this morning. I have a gene expression profile. I have some label. Could be cancer, healthy, could be stage of cancer. I want to see, can I predict, or how do I best predict the response based on this expression profile? And again, a big issue here is that we have a high dimensional vector for prediction, and then we have small numbers of subjects. The last one is class discovery. So in cancer, there have been very sort of standard staging systems that have been developed. You have stage 1 cancer, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. However, scientists who use microarrays want to do is see, can we figure out, are there subtypes based on the molecular expression, and this is being measured by the microarray, of these various stages of cancer? And in particular, can these subtypes better predict clinical response, such as survival? Okay, so I listed those as scientific issues. Going from science to statistics, I look at problem one, and I think a major way people have looked at this problem is as a problem of differential expression, or more generally, variable selection. So scientists think of, you know, biomarker discovery, I think as statisticians we think about how do we select variables. Class prediction becomes, I think, a problem really of classification, supervised learning. And then the last one, class discovery, is what I'll be calling clustering, or corresponds to clustering or unsupervised learning methods, and that's what I'll be spending most of this talk on. So in clustering, typically what's been done is a hierarchical clustering algorithm is run the data. And I think, again, Rod showed a heat map in the previous talk, so I have a picture with a lot less colors, but sort of this sort of example of a procedure becoming popular because of the availability of software. So this software was sort of written for microdata by Mike Eisen, who was previously at Stanford, I think now is at Berkeley. So basically now, basically you can't read a microarray paper without seeing this picture of red and green genes, and you see genes being clustered and samples being clustered as well. Again, I won't have any pictures like that in this talk. What I'll be talking about more is the statistical issues when you sort of have that as your output. And what I'll be talking about quite a bit is thinking about a global hypothesis of clustering versus a local hypothesis of clustering. And I'll define that later in the talk. Okay, so again, this is the non-color intensive version of this clustering output that you'll see in microarray papers. So these are data from a Bittner et al. Paper, which appeared in Nature. They were looking at cutaneous melanomas, and they did a clustering of samples. They used average linkage clustering, and based on some resampling tests they developed, they sort of figured out that right here were so they found a cluster of 19 samples, and they sort of defined that to be sort of a subtype. So this is an example of a molecular subtype they found using clustering. And they did some resampling tests, as I mentioned, to sort of say, is this cluster real? So there's sort of two questions that you can think about in looking at clustering output. The problem with this method is the following. Let's say I have a data set where I have absolutely nothing going on. I feed it into a clustering program, I'm still going to get out a picture like this. I'm going to get a dendrogram no matter what. So one question is there really any signal in the data for separating out groups? And that's going to be related to how many groups are in the data set. A second question is, okay, I have this given group. How do I know whether or not this is a real group? Okay, so these are what I'm going to be calling global hypothesis of clustering and a local hypothesis of clustering. Okay, so again, if we want to put type of statistical framework for clustering, two hypotheses we can talk about. First is there any structure in the data? How many groups are in the data? That's what I'll be calling a global hypothesis. The second one, are the observed groupings or clusters in some sense significant? That's what I'll be calling a local hypothesis. Now, if we were to be sort of classically statistical about it, finding numbers of groups is a very hard problem. It's sort of, in a sort of a classical statistical sense, it's sort of a non-regular problem. So that's sort of something to keep in mind as we go through these methods, is that this is sort of, in some sense, a very sort of ill-posed problem. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about previous work. And because this is a Canadian workshop, I've tried to find the proposals that have Canadian links to them. So, for example, Jenny Bryan, who I believe is at UBC, she and Mark Vanderlyn developed a resampling-based method for addressing, doing inference based on clustering output. Our first speaker today has proposed sort of a gap statistic for assessing number of clusters. So this number of clusters is getting at a global hypothesis of clustering. So Andrine Dudouat and Jade Friedland had also a resampling-based method for assessing number of clusters, as did Lisa McShane and a group at NCI. So again, most of these are looking at this global hypothesis, how many groups are in the data. So what we'll talk about here are two things we've looked at, one for addressing this global hypothesis, Now, we've done it in a model-based way. The other is going to look at the local hypothesis, and we're going to address that using subsampling techniques. Okay, so when I talk about model-based clustering of microdata, what I'm really talking about is fitting a mixture model to microdata. So I'm going to let Y1 through YN be the observations to be clustered, and this is the model that we're fitting. So this is sort of a standard normal mixture model. K, capital K, are the number of components. Mu K is the mean for the kth component. Sigma K is the variance for the kth component. And that's the density down there. So ultimately, what my interest here is making inference about is capital K. It's not necessarily on the mean itself or the variance, but rather how many groups are in the data. So this is that global hypothesis I mentioned earlier. Now, there are going to be two issues that are going to arise. You can talk about clustering genes. You can talk about clustering samples. I start off by talking about we talk about the problem of clustering samples. So our N is small, and the dimension of Y, which is P, written down here, is big. So this is obviously, I can't fit this model, because I have much fewer observations than I do parameters. Or if I want to fit parameters, I need to think about really making restrictions on what parameters to fit. The other problem, talk about clustering genes. So now I'm talking about N being several of thousands of observations, and P is going to be the number of subjects. So I'm interchanging the roles now. So if I want an alpha mixture model, it's going to be the case that you typically fit this using an EM algorithm. To get the initial values, though, is going to be kind of computationally intensive. So we need to figure out methods of sort of faster methods for getting initial values. So those are the two issues I'll be addressing here. So again, clustering samples, we have a problem because dimension of genes is much larger than number of independent samples. Clustering genes, sort of a dimensionality problem in how many genes we have. Okay, clustering samples. So what we did was actually use a two-stage method where we actually apply a dimension reduction at the first stage and then fit a mixture model at the second stage. So what we did was we first try was to apply the principal components to gene expression measurements. So what this does is it takes our gene expression data, which we could say is N by P, N is number of subjects, P is number of genes, and we reduce that dimension down to a lower dimensional space. So if I start off with that first model, model number one here, I apply principal components. That's applying a linear mapping to these data. So because I'm applying linear mapping, I still have So I'm applying basically a matrix A times Y1. So my new data will be A times Y1 up to A times Yn. So given that Yn has this mixture structure, A times Yi will also have this mixture structure as well. So it preserves that mixture structure. And again, I mentioned that what I really want to do is I want to make an inference about capital K. I'm not interested in making an interpretation about the mean or the variance. So at the time, we didn't have sort of clinical data, so we needed an unsupervised method of dimension reduction. You could think about doing more classification-oriented dimension reduction approaches, but we didn't have that here. And again, what we want to do is make inference about how many clusters we had in our data. So we're going to do that using Bayes factors. Now, there is an issue here is how many principal components we want to use. And at this stage, all we've done is look at using sort of a plot, which is a standard procedure, look at a plot of the proportion of variance explained by the principal components, and sort of select the top two or top three or top four. So this is done kind of in an ad hoc way. And I'll talk later about a different way of doing this dimension reduction. So the genes, like I said, if we want to fit this mixture model, we run into a problem of having really high dimensional numbers of genes to cluster. So what we did was we applied initial pre-clustering, and we tried a couple of approaches. The first one was using a minimal spanning tree, And then this will give us the initial group assignments from which you can then fit the mixture model. Another one is something called, sort of based on a resampling-based clustering algorithm. So basically, we create new data sets, and we basically try to identify which genes tend to be in stable groups, and we use that to define our partition. It turned out that using either didn't seem to make a whole lot of difference in terms of interpreting the result, but we found that in either case, it speed up the iterations a lot. And again, this attests to the point of having, you know, a method that's sort of computationally fast. Okay, so I want to go through a couple examples here. So first example is that data I showed you before from NCI. So the goal here is to find disease subtypes of cutaneous melanoma. And again, what the authors have done was apply an average linkage hierarchical clustering. And based on this cutoff value, they then found a 19-sample cluster. They call this a subtype. And then they validated that cluster using two methods they developed in that paper. So what we did was we applied principal components analysis to the measurement, to the data matrix that gives us, and then we fit a sort of a mixture model to the first two principal components. And we looked at, for doing model selection and numbers of clusters, we looked at 1 to 6 clusters for a variety of covariance structures. So notice I'm going from, so here if I look at my gene expression matrix, it's going to be 31 by 36, 13. So I'm going from that to now a 31 by 2 or 31 by 3 matrix. So obviously there's a massive dimension reduction issue that's going on here. So I'll address this point later in the talk as well. Okay, so basically we fit a variety of variant structures, and sort of the one variant structure that seemed compatible with the 19 subtype cluster that the Bittner et al. Group found was this one here. I'm not going to get into details about what these variances mean, but it turned out that some of the other models we fit sort of suggested no structure in the data, meaning just one component, or in fact there are two components, and that the 19 cluster subtype they found had to actually be made bigger. And what's happened, I think, in work since then is that I think the group at NCI, they sort of have expanded that 19 subtype cluster to include some of these other observations. Rob?
Can you talk about the clustering? Didn't change the problem so much that you have a model-based clustering, your model's quite different. Like, for example, the pies are between 0 and 1.
Correct.
Whereas our clustering is a very hard cluster.
Yes.
So you could have 5 clusters which are very clearly separated by our clustering, but your model-based might
That's right. I mean, okay, so first off, higher clustering really, I mean, that notion of a model isn't real. I mean, I guess I think of it as much more of an algorithmic kind of thing. There are situations, like you just described, where higher clustering might be more successful than the model-based. The goal here was really to think about, in terms of doing, for the inference for the K, was trying to think about doing sort of a more probabilistic approach than something that was resampling. So, I mean, we use an approximate-based factor here, which tends to be pretty fast to compute. So, but right. I see. Right. That's right. So, I mean, I guess what we did here was not only did we look at number of components, but we looked at what samples got classified into what groups. So what I'm talking about is also based on those results as well. Okay, so this is now an example of doing model-based clustering based on the genes. So this is data from our study at Michigan at an earlier stage. So we had roughly 4,000 genes, and we had 26 subjects. And it turned out the subjects came from a variety of different cancer types. So metastatic is the most aggressive form of prostate cancer. Localized means the cancer hadn't metastasized. And then we had several other samples that were not localized, non-metastatic. So What we want to do here is thinking about finding candidate genes that might be implicated in prostate cancer. So this is sort of a this is the point where I think there's a departure between statistics and biology. One thing that gets done among biologists is they do this clustering of genes. They have a list of genes. They know which of these genes are oncogenes. If there are any genes that show similar co-expression to the known oncogenes, then they're going to use those. Those are going to be sort of viable candidates for biomarkers. So we fit the mixture model, but in terms of interpreting the output, what the biologist did was sort of look through the list of genes and see if there were any biomarkers that seemed to associate with the genes on the list or in the cluster. So I'll show an example of that in a second. Okay, so there is still this issue of having microarray measurements from cancers at different stages. So we adjusted for that using an analysis of variance model. So actually what we work with isn't the actual gene expression measurement, but rather the residuals from fitting this model, because we wanted to adjust for stage. Okay, so here's one cluster of genes that was picked up by the mixture model method. So it turned out that, so these are known oncogenes. It turned out that a gene that they hadn't been sort of looked at before was this gene called hepsin. It's a serine membrane protease, meaning that it's involved in the immune response and it digests proteins. And because they found that this gene grouped with these known oncogenes, this sort of gave the scientists a lead that, you know, hepsin might be worth following up as a candidate biomarker. So this is sort of, even though I'm talking about class discovery or in the first part, I mean, this is sort of getting at biomarker discovery. And this is sort of one way I think scientists use results from clustering output to sort of figure out what might be interesting candidate genes to study. So what they then did was, this is using cDNA. They wanted to validate this result on a protein level. So they then they sort of had a protein validation experiment, and they found that this was also validated on a protein level. So they're sort of now considering this as a potential candidate biomarker for prostate cancer. So again, I think this sort of shows how sort of statistics can help guide biologists in sort of selection of genes. And this is sort of one way we've looked at. Okay, so going back to the clustering samples problem, what we did was we took the mixture model, we fit it to principal components. So I mentioned there's this big dimension reduction. So one way we thought, you know, how can we better sort of justify doing this is sort of by thinking about projection pursuit ideas. So that sort of says that I have data in this high dimensional space. If I project into lower dimensional spaces, it's going to be the case that most of the projections are going to be normal. And what's going to be not normal is going to be what's sort of interesting in your data. So we sort of use that to sort of motivate a different way of projecting data. So the reason we did this is because I mentioned with this principal components, we picked off sort of the first two or first three based on visual inspection. There have been authors who've argued that there's actually biologically relevant information about gene expression in the lower principal components. So then it becomes an issue of how do you go about picking principal components to use for the mixture model. So we wanted to do something different. So we tried this idea of random projections, which I'll now describe. Okay, so this is a math institute, so there are actually some theorems in this work that we did. So we showed that if you had high probability, you can show that if you take your high dimensional data, project it into lower dimensional space, with high probability, you'll still have sort of a normal mixture model, if your original data come from a normal mixture model. It also turns out, again, with high probability, that if you project data into lower dimensions, you actually end up getting better separability in terms of the mixture components. And we also extended this to scale mixtures so that we could deal with things like mixtures of t-distribution. So here's a random-based projection clustering algorithm I mentioned earlier. So p is the number of genes, and d is the constant. And basically, we create this matrix A of normal ID, normal 0, 1 random variables. So next step is we make the matrix orthogonal, and we do that just by using Gram-Schmidt. And then we take our original expression data, and we project the data using A. This gives us new observations, and then we sort of fit mixture model to the projected data using the EAM algorithm. So one question is, how does this compare to what we had done before using PCA? So one thing we did was we did a small simulation study where we compared these two approaches for, in terms of trying to find subtypes. So here's, I'll say a little bit about the simulation. We had 100 subjects, 1,000 genes. We had them coming from two different normal populations, and so we have two subtypes, and we want, so it's going to be the case that probably not all genes contribute to distinguishing subtypes, so we assumed here that I think 10% of the genes were differentially expressed between the two, so that you could discriminate, you could actually in theory discriminate between the two subtypes based on 100 genes, but we have all 1,000, because we want to see how does the projection thing work. So because we know this is a simulation study, we know which subjects come from group 1, which subjects come from group 2, we can then assess how well are we sort of classifying the subtypes based on this projection method. Okay, so again, we looked at a variety of situations. I think the first thing that was sort of really interesting is if you look at the simulation results, they don't change a whole lot. And I should say this is based on 100 simulation settings for each case. So there are, we generate 100 data sets for each of these settings. The first thing you notice is that the numbers aren't changing a whole lot. So, and I think the reason that probably is because, I mean, you're doing sort of such a massive dimension reduction that maybe in all cases the data probably don't have much information for discriminating between these kinds of models. It looks like the random projection is actually doing a little bit better than the SVD. You know, roughly, you know, it's 15% better. There's an issue here that I don't really describe, but how you go about picking D is something we haven't thought about at all. Obviously, that's going to make a big difference as well. In the simulation, we just looked at, you know, treating D fixed in each of these settings. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is, so I've been talking pretty much about global hypotheses. I also want to talk a little bit about local hypothesis clustering. So, as I mentioned before, the number of samples we have is much smaller than the number of genes that we have on a chip. So, again, small n, large p. So it turns out so one idea we had was the following. Instead of using the entire gene expression profile of the cluster samples, let's think about clustering samples based on a fraction of the spots on the microarray. So it should be the case that if we recluster based on a subset, that stable clusters should be replicated on average. So basically, this sort of motivated the approach we looked at, which was sort of performing a sensitivity analysis for clustering output, where we recluster samples using subsets of genes to address local hypotheses. So what we're going to get here is actually a stability score for the clustering output. So we have a given cluster. We're going to basically create these new data sets where we have fractions of genes used, recluster things, and see how often in the reclustered sample, how often the reclustered samples duplicate our original clustered samples. That's going to be the stability score. Now, obviously, the bigger the cluster is, the less likely it's going to be to cluster together completely in a reclustered in a new data set where we sort of do it this way. So we also looked at developing a cluster size adjusted measure for assessing stability. So going back to that Bittner et al. Data, one thing I should mention about this local hypothesis, this is saying, is a given cluster significant or is it important or is it stable? If you use hierarchical clustering, the observed grouping is going to depend very much on how many clusters you estimate there to be in the data. So there's actually a two-stage process where we first estimate how many clusters do we have in the data, conditional on how many clusters there are, are these observed groupings stable or not? Okay, so this is looking at, what we did here was we did an average hyperclustering of samples. So you'll get a picture like we did exactly that I showed before. Based on the clustering, it turned out that in this example, we had four clusters that were had at least two subjects in them. So there were 31 samples. So the other four were basically singleton clusters. And we basically created these stability scores based for the clusters with more than singletons in them. So what we found was that, so cluster one is a 21 sample cluster. So this is sort of not the 19, but an expanded version of the 19 in that picture I showed earlier. And what you see is that obviously if we don't take the size into account, we're getting, you know, this is the fraction of genes we use for the reclustering. What we find is that the scores are really, really look really bad, basically. So basically you want high scores mean high stability, low scores mean low stability. So scores here look really bad, but if we take the size into account, so we now see that the score is, you know, doing a lot better for sure. So this cluster, this 21, if we take it into account, we see that if we use 85% of the genes to recluster, and we basically pick a different 85% every time, we see that it ends up, if you adjust for cluster size, it appears in 83% of the sets. Obviously, when you have samples of size 2, it's much more likely that they'll end up being clustering together in these newly created data sets. Although it turns out that this cluster of 2 and this cluster of 2, they actually don't appear together. So I think the guideline we sort of figured out looking at other data sets is that, in general, you want to be using, to do this subsampling, you want to look at using about 80% of the genes. And if the gene appears, if the score, adjusting for cluster size, is around 0.75 or higher, we take that as evidence of a stable cluster. So we looked at these data. So based on that cutoff, this is actually a pretty stable cluster. We looked at some other data sets in literature. For example, one that Rob looked at by Alizade et al., looking at the diffuse B-cell lymphomas. They found a cluster, I believe, of 41 samples. Again, Rob will probably know the details better. But we found that cluster we found to be a pretty stable one using sort of the 0.8 threshold that I mentioned. So this sort of gives you a way of looking at, is your observed grouping stable? It uses the fact that you have a lot of genes that you're basing the clustering on, and it sort of, you know, involves this resampling idea. How are we doing on time? Okay, great. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of where I think clustering is headed. So I do think it's a very important problem in genomic data analysis for the reasons I mentioned before. I think scientists are interested in finding subtypes. They want to see, can we use the molecular data to better predict clinical response above and beyond sort of traditional staging. I do think that even though clustering itself is an unsupervised method, you really want to think carefully about why does the scientist want to do clustering? What's the goal? And I think that will, because there are a lot of choices involved in clustering. Even, let's say you don't even decide to develop a new method. Hyperclustering has issues of what metric should I be using? Should I use average linkage versus complete linkage? And I mean, I think, you know, these choices can be probably, I think one way, instead of trying every which combination of hyperclustering, you can think about what do the scientists want? What does he expect? How can we sort of incorporate that into our choices for clustering? I do think, so what I've done so far hasn't used any sort of clinical information. Now, we have collected this information at Michigan. So I think developing approaches to clustering that are more supervised is probably a good thing, because you want to know, is the subtype you're finding meaningful? One way of determining that is to sort of link it to some kind of outside clinical information. And Rob's done some work on gene shaving, which is definitely a step in that direction. I do think the last thing, though, is sort of, I think, where I think the field is headed, in that we want to think more about how can we incorporate external biological knowledge into data analysis. So I'm talking about microdata analysis, but I think more generally the problem of I think you can apply this to the issue of clustering as well. So here's a example. One thing we started to look at is gene expression measurements and how it relates to chromosome location. So in cancer, some of the cancers can be caused by chromosomal aberrations. So the cancer gene gets overamplified, it translocates, there are other possibilities. So there's definitely interest in trying to determine what effect chromosome location plays on gene expression. So we could now think about, and it sort of relates to what Rob was mentioning at the end of his talk, how do we order things along a gene, or how do we create an ordering for gene expression? And one way is to think about ordering things based on chromosomal location. So the example, I talked about cancer, but the example data I have is actually from a yeast study. And here they're looking at yeast gene expression as a function of chromosome location. It turns out biologically for yeast that peaks correspond to something known as a replication origin, and valleys correspond to a replication terminus. So these are important because, as probably most of you know now, DNA replicates. So knowing where DNA replication begins on the genome, where it ends, I think is very important in better understanding that process. So thinking about how we could sort of incorporate that information into clustering, I think is an important direction to think about. Okay, so last slide is acknowledgments. So the biologist I've worked with at Michigan is Arul Chinayan. And again, this work is very much driven by his questions. It's not my thinking, let's develop a new algorithm, let's apply it to microdata. It's much more, Arul has directed questions, and we've used these methods to sort of address those questions. Mark Smolkin, who was a student in our department, who's now at Virginia, did the programming for the stability scores. Here are some references for the material on which I talked about today, and papers you can get at the website. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes for some questions.
Somebody said that when you predict the high-dimensional data on a couple of small dimensions, the positions are normal or mixtures are normal. But then you say what's left is what's not normal. Can you say what you mean by what's left?
I didn't mean what's left. I guess what I meant to say is that the non-Gaussian directions are what are interesting in the lower dimensional spaces. That's what I meant, but just to clarify my comment. Exactly. ICA, projection pursuit, I mean, that whole literature. That's correct. I thought I saw a question back there.
I can offer a comment on the theorem. There's a theorem by Cal Romano that random projections anything.
Random projections, if anything, are Gaussian. Of anything, are Gaussian. Okay.
But the suggestion is, based on the fact that if a gene is just representing noise, it'll appear somewhat Gaussian. And so it's kurtosis, the fourth molar, will be about what it would be for the Gaussian. If there's clustering with respect to the gene, the fourth molar will be smaller than it should be. So I've tried a number of cases and found it kind of useful, but I need to be convinced why it does it. But I would strongly recommend taking the 3,000 genes, calculating the kurtosis, standardized fourth molar, and taking the 20% that have got the smallest kurtosis and repeating. And you'll get rid of the noise genes, which are found to be in all the principal components.
Thank you for the suggestion. I mean, that's sort of one thing we grapple with quite a bit, was just how to think about removing the noise. Typically we've done, filtering based on variance, but obviously if we're doing clustering using normal mixture models or clustering based on principal components, that's probably not the thing you want to be doing. So I appreciate the comments, and I think you've just given Mark some more work to do when I get back to Michigan. 20 minutes. Any other questions?
Okay, let's thank Tabashis again.